There's a lot of concern about burnout and depression among medical students, residents, and physicians. The doctor I'm about to talk to is attempting to do something about all these issues. Welcome to the 282nd episode of Admissions Straight Talk, Accepted's podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. This episode is sponsored by Accepted's downloadable guide, the ultimate guide to medical school interview success. Learn how to prepare effectively for interviews, handle difficult questions, send the right messages with your body language, and follow up after the interview. The guide is free and linked to from our show notes at accepted.com/282. Our guest today, Dr. Elizabeth Poorman, is an internist at Cambridge Medical. She grew up in Chicago, attended medical school at Emory, and did her internal medical training at Cambridge Health Alliance, where she now works in Everett, Massachusetts. Her primary patient population is immigrants and those dealing with addiction. In her spare time, she also writes movingly and well about the challenges facing physicians and physicians in training. Her writing has appeared in Doximity, Kevin MD, and other sites on the web. Oh, and she's also a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical. Dr. Poorman, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Can you tell us a little bit about your background? I mean, I know I said you grew up in Chicago, but a little bit more about it. What do you like to do for fun? How you got interested in medicine, et cetera?
Sure. I mean, I think I was one of those weird kids who always knew I would become a physician. Applying for medical school, you know, you come up with a moment when the heavens opened up and you decided to become a doctor. But, you know, really, I was one of those kids that, you know, love to rush to people who are injured, take care of them, who was always fascinated by the human body. So it's always been something that I wanted to do.
Now, on some of your writing, it appeared that perhaps in college you became a little bit less sure. Is that true? Or did I misinterpret something there?
No, that is definitely true. I think that so much of what we do on the path to becoming a physician has nothing to do with medicine. And that was certainly true in college, you know, taking chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, you know, which I enjoyed the content of, but felt like that it mostly served of a purpose of weeding out individuals from medicine as opposed to, you know, really opening up your mind and your sense of inquiry. Which ideally I think is the job of any great college course. And I, you know, I was looking at the people around me who seemed very sure of their path. And I didn't really feel like I fit in with them. In retrospect, most of them ended up going into investment banking anyways. You know, I think at the time they were very high achieving people who saw medicine as a good financial decision, and then later on made a different choice, which, you know, probably earned them quite a bit more money. So a lot of those people ended up washing out of medicine. And after a little bit working after college, working in different nonprofits, you know, doing different international work, I decided that I really did want to pursue this path, that I wanted to have a skill and a way of, you know, directly helping people. And so I found my way back to medicine.
Okay. You mentioned on your website, which we will link to from the show notes at accepted.com/282, that you were working on a leprosy history project in Brazil, and that's when you kind of recommitted, if you will, to becoming a doctor. Why there? I assume you did at least one gap year. I think you mentioned that you did. And can you tell us a little bit more about that moment?
Sure. I did my undergraduate thesis on leprosy in Brazil. And I was so fascinated with it. And I continue to be fascinated with the ways that patients were treated and mistreated in Brazil. And I know that this, you know, experience repeated itself in different countries in different ways. But the one that I'm more intimately familiar with is Brazil, that, you know, patients were separated from their families and experimented on. Their children were taken away from them. And this is, you know, not a very distant past. These people are, you know, still alive and eager to share their story. So that's what I studied for my thesis. And I was incredibly lucky to spend so much time with people who are living in the colonies, people who had had, you know, what we now call Hansen's disease, who had been cured of it, but that the effects were long lasting. And I was fascinated with the ways that science and medicine were manipulated for different political aims, because it was clear very early on that this wasn't a particularly contagious disease.
Really?
Yes. It was since the 1940s, it was well known that being in close contact with people with leprosy wasn't necessarily going to give you leprosy. And in fact, not a single person who worked in the colonies got leprosy. And that was not unclear to the people who created this plan of isolation. So I wanted to know, you know, if that was known, then why? And it seems more, it was an easy way for them to say that they were doing something about the problem, and then also to have full dominion over these patients that they wanted to experiment on. So it's a really dark chapter in medicine's history. But you know, the people that I was working with, even though they had experienced the worst of the medical profession, didn't tell me not to go to medical school. They said, we want you to become a doctor. We want you to remember, you know, what our experience was and like what, how wrong things can go. And to be, you know, not, and what, they use this expression, which sounds much more beautiful in Portuguese, seja médica de profissão. Seja médico de coração, não só de profissão. And that means, you know, be a doctor because it's in your heart, not just because it's your profession. So I found that to be really inspiring, and I carried those experiences with me.
Wow, that's quite some experience. Okay. How did you get interested in leprosy in Brazil?
So I studied the history of science. You know, I was part of that period where I was in these, you know, pre-medicine courses with people who didn't seem interested in the material and just wanted to get a good grade. And so I was looking for something that would kind of, you know, stoke my curiosity. But, you know, fundamentally, I'm most interested in medicine. That's what drives me. And so the history of science was a way for me to think about science in a more global way, to think about, you know, the limitations of it, and the, you know, the logical fallacy. So it was really fantastic. And the history of science, like most, you know, most history, most literature, is very American and European focused. And there was this opportunity to study in Brazil, and I thought that this would be a great chance to expand, you know, scholarship in this field, to non-white, non-European countries. And I met some people who were working with this advocacy organization and just kind of went from there.
Fascinating. So how long was the gap between college and medicine, medical school for you?
It was 2 years. So I worked on that project, and I also worked on a project at Harvard Medical School studying cultural competency in medicine.
Okay. Now, so you took the 2 years off, you applied to medical school, you got into Emory. What did you like best about your medical school experience at Emory?
I was lucky enough to work a lot at Grady. And Grady is a very large public hospital that, like all the great hospitals, public hospitals in America, has the mission of serving everyone, regardless of who they are. And because the need is so great, there's a lot of chance for, you know, medical students to really advocate for patients and to really, you know, support and expand the services that the team is offering. So I think I was really lucky in that way. I think a lot of, you know, medical students who are working with a wealthier population, it can be a little bit difficult because there's not necessarily a role for them. They end up more observing, and then they're also, you know, not necessarily seeing the, you know, extreme diseases of poverty that you see when you work in a large county hospital.
Right, right. Okay. How did you decide to focus on internal medicine and addiction?
I decided to do internal medicine because I wanted something that was really broad. And then I kind of, you know, was internal medicine versus family medicine. I don't really know if it was, you know, clearly right or wrong, the decision. But, you know, being on the East Coast, family medicine is a little bit less strong than it is on the West Coast. So I think, you know, had I been in a different place, I might have done family medicine. But I loved internal medicine's focus on the pathological basis of disease, mm-hmm. and deeply satisfied the nerd that lives inside of me, and, you know, loves to do like calculations and then look up like what's the like molecular basis for this, even, you know, even if the answer is the same. So I really love that aspect of internal medicine. And then, you know, addiction, I'm responding to, you know, the great scourge of my time and, you know, mm-hmm. what is actually killing my patients is addiction. So I had some training in addiction, but it's mostly been on the job training, you know, working with people and keeping, you know, I think my history of science background really was quite helpful there because, you know, we talk about paradigm shifts a right. lot in the history of science. So we talk about, you know, how we conceive of a particular thing and then how all of, eventually enough evidence builds up that you have to question what you're thinking, what you're doing. And no better example of that than the opioid crisis. So for right. years, we're told to give more and more highly addictive opioid medications to patients and that it's not a problem. And then eventually there's just so much death and so much suffering that we have to really then turn around and say, where did this information come from? Is it really correct? Like, are we practicing sound medicine? And I, you know, I think that's been really difficult for people, but my training has helped me kind of wrap my mind around that. And also to be excited about the paradigm shifts and think truly, not just saying that addiction is a disease, but truly behaving as if addiction is a disease that we are, as physicians, needing to address and to treat.
Right, right. It's a horrible problem. Let's move forward. I want to transition to a little bit of your writing and your work outside the clinic. And I just want to ask you before we go on, are you You obviously, again, you were one of the people who kind of was born thinking you wanted to be a doctor, and then in college you doubted it, and then and with your work in Brazil, you came back to commit to it. We're going to start, I'm going to ask you about some of the more difficult aspects of being a doctor, but I want to just start with a foundational question, which is, are you overall happy that you became a doctor, you became a physician?
Yeah, I mean, I am happy that I became a physician. I think we're at a really unique time period, and it's something that I'm still trying to wrap my head around, like, what is the way forward? Because I do consider the American healthcare system to be a deeply immoral system that promotes suffering in search of profit. And unfortunately, medicine has been traditionally incredibly conservative, and we've been taught to keep politics out of the clinic room, to not engage with advocacy. But then the end result of that is aiding and abetting a system that doesn't treat people in a humane fashion, and continues to get worse for both patients and providers. The short answer is yes, and the longer answer is yes, and then now what? So how do I use my training and my outrage and my sense of injustice on behalf of my patients and my colleagues to help create a better system?
Okay, let's circle back to that question in a minute. All right. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time, either in medical school or since, when you really wondered if you'd made a mistake and thought about leaving medicine?
Yeah, I experienced a very severe episode of depression my intern year, which I've
so that's the first year about. After medical school, right?
Exactly. Which I've written a lot about. And at the time, it felt like a very individual experience. It felt like I was the only one. It felt like everyone around me was, thriving and doing so well. And I was just, really failing. I was taking much longer to complete notes. I was feeling overwhelmed by my patient suffering. I was, just not feeling like I measured up. And I was so lucky to have, people around me who supported me, and particularly people who were further along in the program than me, and who openly told me, I would say openly, but in private told me, I experienced depression as well. It's not an uncommon thing, and I got a lot better, and I think you're going to get better too. And it was hard to believe at the time. I think, the really terrible thing about depression is that you lose your perspective and your insight, and you feel isolated, and it's hard to reach out to people. So I'm forever grateful to those people who were vulnerable with me. And once I got better, I ended up being very vocal about it in response to some very public suicides that happened in New York towards the end of my intern year. Unfortunately, they're not the last ones that have happened. And people started coming to me and asking for advice. And I think it just kind of shows how few people are willing to talk about this. Was when I, when I started digging into what was known about depression in residency training and after residency training, it's so common as to be almost a rite of passage.
It's kind of interesting, when I was reading some of your articles, and obviously I know that it's a significant issue. It's a definite problem. And we actually had on about a year ago now, somebody called the Happy Doc, who's trying to, in his own way, I guess, address the issue. But one of the things that struck me is, medical students are kind of famous for imagining themselves having all kinds of rare diseases once they study them,
Yeah.
So why is depression, which is increasingly common among medical students and in society as a whole, why is it that they're missing that in themselves? Do you know? Do you have any theories at least?
I have quite a few theories. I think, but fundamentally the most important thing is stigma. Depression in physicians is seen as a sign of weakness. And I think that has to do with the larger stigma of mental health in our society. How can we be telling patients that you're going to get better, that this is a normal disease process, that we have treatment for it, when we don't behave that way for ourselves? So I think that's one aspect of it. But I think, there's a larger cultural issue in medicine where we like to think of ourselves as these sort of hero physicians, and it starts in the pre-med courses in college. I was intimidated by those people who would stay up all night and memorize all these facts that are completely irrelevant in order to get a good grade. and thought that, you know, maybe I didn't have what it takes because I wasn't like that. So, you know, I think, you know, as we go along, we any sign of vulnerability is a chance for somebody to not make it. So then you have this highly selected, you know, group of people in medical school, and then you're faced with, you know, ultimately a problem that's unsolvable. We're all going to die. Death always wins, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Only thing certain is, right, death and taxes.
Yeah. So, you know, so there's a certain amount of that process that's necessarily heartbreaking.
Sure.
And I think, you know, I think if you're not depressed at some point in your training, you're probably not paying attention. So, you know, I think there's that. And then on top of that, like I mentioned earlier, you have a system that treats people deeply unequally and, you know, causes a lot of suffering in the name of profit. And so I think, you know, to be at the crux of that is really crushing, and we're not given a lot of outlets to change that or to advocate for a better system. But I, you know, I think that there's so much fear of acknowledging that you could be suffering, you know, suffering from depression. And then when people do talk about suffering from depression or suicidality, they're often punished for it. And this is a point that I have a really hard, I feel very stuck, because I think that there's a lot of advocates that don't want to discuss this, that they want to say, oh, all you have to do as a physician is to reach out. Well, in many states, the Board of Medicine will actually ask you to disclose if you've had any kind of mental health treatment. And that, I think, is so bizarre to me, because really, like, with the level of depression, substance abuse, other mental health issues in medical training, what they should be saying is, if you haven't had mental health treatment, you're probably in trouble, and here's where you should go. And instead, we're stigmatizing, you know, we're stigmatizing appropriate care, and I don't understand that. So I think that medical students will, you know, they'll rationalize away what they're feeling. Everyone else around them is feeling the same. And then that continues to on through the rest of their careers. And I can't tell you how many times I've been cornered at a party or some social event where a physician in practice, you know, let's say 20, 30 years out of practice, mm-hmm. Will come up to me and say, wow, you guys are really experiencing a lot of depression. I don't know what's going on with you. Maybe you're not as resilient as we were. And then by the end of the conversation, they will say, well, I guess I was really depressed in training, or I think I'm depressed right now. And it's such a regular thing. I can almost time it. And I try not to say anything until they get to that realization.
That was one of the questions that I prepared for you, is that, do you think the problem of physician depression has increased, or is that just a perception, perhaps due to more reporting of or more discussion of depression?
I think that there certainly is more discussion, but I do think it is getting worse. And the reason that I think is getting worse over time is that the complexity of medicine is increasing at an exponential rate. Mm-hmm. But continue to train physicians as if it's the 1950s. So, you know, we're asking people to, you know, memorize things, you know, stuff, you know, note cards, whatever, and to, you know, use systems and, you know, ways of thinking through problems that just don't apply anymore. And then on top of that, the productivity requirements and the simultaneous dysfunction of the system are spiraling out of control. And there doesn't seem to be an end in sight.
Right. That was one of the things that I was thinking, and I'm not a physician. I've never, you know, never been a physician. I've been in hospital environments, but, you know, with sick relatives and whatnot. But, you know, one of the things I didn't have, let's say 20, 30 years ago, was any kind of work roles Now, I realize that the work rules for residents are sometimes not the most effective thing in the world, and they're still pretty heavy in terms of what's allowed. But you would think that that might help a little bit, just because people who are not rested are more likely to get depressed.
I'm afraid that I find the work rules to be a very anemic and somewhat disingenuous response to a true crisis. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, you know, first of all, 60 hours a week is still too many hours, probably.
I think it's 80, isn't it?
Yeah, it is 80. But yeah. 60 hours a week is what we have in other countries. And then on mm-hmm. top of that, you have people who, you know, and then you go home and you have to study, right? So after the work hours, really, residents weren't really working fewer hours. Programs simply did these kind of complicated redesigns where people were, you know, doing more overnight shifts. Certain parts of the hospital were less and less staffed. Because the number of resident slots didn't increase. So it's the same amount of work, but then you have these, kind of external work hours, which I think were quite necessary, but they're really only a first step. The second thing is that residents are doing way too much work, and it's continuing to get worse over time. There's more mm-hmm. and more admissions to hospitals. There's more and more paperwork, and there's just more stuff to know every yeah. year. The conversation has been kind of stuck on work hours, when to me that should be a done deal. Like, that's clear that it's not safe for patients, and it's not safe for physicians. It's not safe for other people on the road when we drive home from our 24-hour shift. Right. Working like this. Unfortunately, I don't think it's in the best interest of any of the deciders to actually deal with the problem. And so they end up focusing on work hours and sort of driving a wedge between generations of physicians. So older physicians saying the classic words of somebody who's been abused, "I went through it and so should you." right?
Well, yeah.
But is this the best way to make a physician? And I don't know why the conversation is not, well, I do know why, but the conversation has not been around that when it that's how it should be shifting.
Okay. Now, some of your articles deal with the issues of burnout and depression among physicians, and you distinguish between burnout and depression. What's the difference?
Well, I will say, first of all, that I don't really like the term burnout because I think it's not particularly clear. Okay. Different definitions and different articles. But I think the larger issue with the term burnout is that researchers mean one thing and the public hears something completely different. So what researchers mean is compassion fatigue. The more you extend yourself, the sicker, the poorer, the needier the population that you're working with, the more likely you are to experience burnout, because there's a limit to what human beings can process. Whereas the public, when they hear my physician is burned out, will think, well, my physician doesn't care. And in fact, it's the opposite. So I tend to avoid the term burnout. And I like to focus on depression because, one, I think depression is incredibly underrecognized. And two, I, as a provider who actually sees other providers in my practice, I have several times had physicians say to me, "Oh, I'm burned out, I'm burned out, I'm burned out." And I will, you know, say to them, "You know, actually, I think you're suffering from a major depressive episode, and you need treatment." So I think, you know, people use it as a euphemism, even for their own condition. That, you know, prevents them from getting, you know, necessary and effective care.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about it. You know, people talk about burnout very casually, but exactly. Depression, you know, I'm burned out today. You know, there can be all kinds of burnout, right? Depression is a clinical condition, though, and I think that would probably harken back to your earlier comment that there's a stigma associated with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, you know, burnout allows hospital administrators to say, you know, you're burned out. You need to, you know,
take a couple of days off.
Right. You need to take a couple. Well, they never want us to take a couple of days off, but you're burned out. So, you know, come to this mandatory luncheon where we'll give you a PowerPoint presentation about why you shouldn't be burned out. And we've done something about the problem. Whereas if you truly acknowledge that, you know, somewhere between a quarter and half of your, providers are suffering from major depression at some point in their careers, then it's not something that you can pay lip service to. That's a very, very serious problem. And I think that burnout has kind of hijacked that conversation.
Now, you recently wrote the article, "Congrats, Med School Grad. Now it's time to find a therapist." Do you basically feel that all medical school graduates should have a therapist?
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. And I do, you know, for that fundamental reason of what I said before, death always wins. So even if your system is totally functional, supportive place, you have, you know, adequate sleep and you're eating properly and your family members are supportive. And, you know, and I say all that, but I don't know a resident yet who can say that. Then there are still going to be days when you are going to have a lot of difficulty processing the terrible things that happen to your patients and the things that you are unable to stop and may not feel adequate to stop. So I think, you know, in terms of a medical school student's, you know, own, and really I want to say, like, congrats, you know, incoming medical student, time to find a therapist. I think, you know, for their own individual health is incredibly important. And then I think for, as a performance issue, stay healthy enough to, treat your patients in the way that they deserve to be treated. Everyone needs to have a therapist. And then the third thing is, you know, today is National Physician Suicide Awareness Day. We have incredibly high rates of suicide in our profession. And it's very difficult to navigate a system and find a provider when you're already feeling terrible and you're not feeling great about yourself. You know, I mean, when I tried to find a therapist in the community, I cold called 20 people. And I did that because things kind of came to a head, but not everyone is ready to do that.
Right, right. Must have been a pretty dark moment.
I felt a little better because I was doing something about it and I was ready to call it what it was, which was depression. And then once I named it, I felt, because of the training that I got that sees mental health as a medical problem with treatment, I felt like, yes, I am going to get better. I just need to get the right care in place.
Now, you obviously did have at least somewhat of a support system, but what do you think medical schools and residency programs should do to either reduce the incidence of physician depression, if you think it can be reduced, or to offer care and support to medical students, residents, and attendings, young doctors?
Yeah, so I think that those are two interrelated problems. I say to any organization, and it's surprising to me how few advocacy organizations are willing to speak openly about physician suicide and prefer instead to talk about burnout. But I say to any advocacy organization, any consultant group, anybody working with physicians that's concerned about these issues of burnout, needs to have real comprehensive, confidential mental health care support in place. So I think that's incredibly important because, you know, we we see our colleagues, if we see that our when our colleagues are suffering, and they try to seek care, that they're treated in ways that stigmatize them, and make their situation worse, which is often the case, then it just discourages everyone else from seeking care. And I will say that, you know, I work with a psychiatrist, Wesley Boyd, who's been a great advocate for physicians seeking mental health care. And he said to me that when he treats physicians in his practice for a wide variety of mental health issues, on average, they've been suffering for 7 years before they seek care. So I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of intervention that can be done on that side. But, you know, a lot of the reasons that people become depressed is that our work conditions continue to deteriorate. And I don't see a lot of serious solutions on the other side. So, the Committee for Interns and Residents, which is a union that works with residents across the country, has done some really effective interventions at different programs that are focused on decreasing the administrative burden for residents so that they can spend more time with patients. And then in my practice, I'm individually looking for ways that I can do that. And one thing that I've noticed is that when I look at the screen, I don't feel as engaged with the patient, and the patient senses that I'm not as engaged with them, because the screen, right, the electronic health record system, is actually designed to draw my attention away from them. I mean, you say of course, and yet it's very difficult for us to get people who design these systems to admit that. So I actually bring a notebook and pen in the room with the patient. I try to let them speak as long as I can without interrupting them. We make an agenda together, and then I go and hide somewhere as soon as I can to write the note as quickly as possible, because the last time I'm on the screen, the more satisfied I am, the more satisfied my patients are. But I'm also not willing to go home to 6 and 7 hours of charting like a lot of my colleagues. So it's tough to try to figure that out, but it's amazing to me that we have allowed a system, to be created this way that is actually designed to make it impossible for us to do our jobs.
Yeah, I was just thinking, about times I've been to a restaurant or lunch place, and you see people at the table next to you, and all they're talking, they're both on their phone.
Yeah,
they got their nose in the phone, and you're like, what are you? And they have somebody at the table with them.
Yeah,
I understand if you don't have somebody at the table with you, but if you have, you don't. You know, there's somebody across from them, and they're not talking to that person because the little gadget has grabbed their attention.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to be fair to the people who created these systems, I think, you know, when they put them in place, we didn't really understand the effects of screens on our brains. And now we understand like how truly compelling they are to the attention. So I try to not use them as much as possible as I can in the room with the patient.
When my kids were little, we went to a physician, and he had his practice was somewhat unusual in that, you know, normally you call a pediatrician and they say the doctor will call you back, right? Either at lunch for if you call in the morning, or at five after five if you call in the afternoon. That wasn't his practice. He always took calls. But what he would do is he would go into the next, you know, room, patient room, and he'd take a bunch of calls. And then he put the phone down, and he gave you his undivided attention. And then he'd go to he'd finish with you, and then he'd go to the next room. He'd take calls, hang up the phone, and then he gave that patient the undivided attention. Mm-hmm. Now, I actually liked that, because I knew that if I was home and I had a sick kid, all right, sometimes I'd have to wait 15 minutes to get through, but I could talk to the doctor. Mm-hmm. So I never resented, when he would take a call, right? But I do remember having his absolutely undivided attention.
Yeah.
And now when I go to a doctor, well, it depends on the doctor, but I'm thinking about my regular physician. The first thing he does is he'll say hello, and then he'll look at the computer, the medical records. He'll review the records. Now, in his case, once he, you know, he reviews the records, he talks to me, and then he turns away from the machine and you know, talks directly with me. But that is important.
It is. I mean, and I, you know, I think the thing is, you know, why is there no time in our day built in our day to review your record before we see you? You know, I don't think anyone has really seriously thought, you know, unless they're in, you know, some sort of innovative concierge practice, but these hospital systems that most of us work for haven't seriously thought about how do you actually structure a patient visit so that it's meaningful for the patient. You know, so instead what we have is, you know, I get 20 minute slots with my patients. A lot of people get 15. You know, let's say you arrive right when your visit starts. And, you know, we have a certain amount of no-shows. So there's only a certain amount of prep work that I can do on my own time. So you arrive when your visit starts, you get checked in, that takes 5 minutes, then you get brought into the room, you get your vitals done, the 15 forms that, you know, somebody from our insurance program decided that we need to fill out that are not particularly helpful to me, you know, and really, like, by the time I get in the room, it's the end of their visit. And I, you know, try to give them my undivided attention. And I spend a lot of the time having to limit people and say, you know, I know that you have these six concerns, but we really need to focus on one. And I think, you know, then try as hard as I can to you know, make sure all the orders are in correctly. It's a nightmare. And then I think a lot of providers are terrified of going home to, you know, 30 charts that they have to close. And not having a life. And that's the reality for a lot of people, is that they're writing notes until midnight every night. It's totally unsustainable.
No, that is totally unsustainable.
Yeah. And we're not talking about that. So I sort of am finding myself at this crossroads where I see the kind of wholesale collapse of primary care happening. And it's not really being taken seriously by decision makers.
Is that why you said the system was an immoral system earlier in the call?
I think it's an immoral system in what it does to providers, but more so in what it does to patients. You know, I was thinking recently about this woman in Boston who got trapped between a train and the platform.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The people around her pushed the train off of her and pulled her out. Incredible. But somebody started to call an ambulance, and she screamed at them not to do it because she couldn't afford it. And we live in the richest country in the world. And that was in Boston, one of the richest cities in the richest countries in the world, where the uninsurance rate is the lowest in the country. And this is the situation, right? So I think that, yes, American medicine is an immoral system that hasn't figured out a way to provide basic care to, you know, all Americans and everyone living here. You know, that to me is just a fundamental tenet of what healthcare should be doing. And we're not doing that. And there's no excuse for it. So, you know, when you're on the front line of that constantly, it can be soul crushing. And so it's really important to find ways to speak out about that, you know, for your own sanity, but also because we can't continue like this.
How do you see your career evolving?
I think I want to keep working with physicians. Most people who go into medicine because they want to help people.
Right.
And that gets beaten out of us to a certain extent through our training programs and then in practice. So I want to keep working with, you know, physicians, physician assistants, nurses, you know, other healthcare workers, you know, to say, how can we create a system that, you know, feels right, where you feel like you can advocate for your patients? And, you know, I try to do that on an individual level with medical students, you know, with colleagues, and then, you know, in a larger sense, writing about what we're experiencing, and maybe in the future doing more research oriented towards that.
Okay. What would you have liked me to ask you?
I don't know. I feel like I've shared a lot of my thoughts with you.
You have.
Yeah.
That's good. That's the idea.
Yeah. I would say, I just want to give, I mean, I know we talked a lot about reasons that, you know, people become depressed and, you know, rates of depression. I would say, you know, if your question is, if people are listening to this and their question is, what can I do about this? I am feeling like I'm suffering.
I have another question, and you should answer the one you posed. What if I'm thinking of going to medical school? What can I do to prevent myself from getting depressed? But that's a separate question. Go answer the one you were going to answer.
Then yeah. So I would say if you currently feel like you need help, or you're concerned that may become an issue for you in the future, I would first reach out to your colleagues and ask them about their experiences, because the support systems are highly local. And a lot of people will have experienced what you've experienced. And I think, you know, because of the stigma in our culture, maybe not everyone is going to respond positively, but a lot of people are going to be really grateful that you're open and vulnerable to them, in the way that I'm grateful for those people who were, and will be able to help direct you. And I would also encourage people to look for mental health providers outside of their system, because it, you know, kind of decreases, you know, that fear of confidentiality, but also, you know, is, I think, more therapeutic to be able to leave wherever you're working and to see a provider. And then if you're going into medical school or residency and you're listening to me talk and it's feeling overwhelming, I get that a lot. But I think what I would say is that you have to remember that you are your most important patient. So your health, your well-being has to be number one always. And if you're in a situation where you're not able to take care of yourself, then you're not going to be operating in a way to take care of your patients in the way that you need to. So you know, make sure that you have, you know, family and friends and, you know, healthy food and, you know, to the extent that you can be able to work out and sleep and see a mental health provider, you know, and do all those things that are, you know, necessary for you to be well, because this is a really tough job.
It certainly is. Your last point reminds me of the airplane videos. You know, when you're on the airplane and they show the safety video and they say, you know, put your own oxygen mask on first and then help the person next to you.
Yeah. And I think when I was younger, I thought, well, that's, you know, that's crazy. You should help the person next to you. But then, then you have like a 3-year-old next to you trying to put a mask on a man that's just passed out. Right. So that's
right,
not possible.
Right. No, right? That's the point of the video. And I think that's the point you're making.
Yeah. That is the point I'm making. Absolutely.
Okay. And so for the pre-med wannabes, in terms of maintaining their mental health, is it just a matter, it's a matter of trying to maintain balance in their lives, and being aware that they could be susceptible to depressive episodes and then they need to seek care.
Yeah. And I would also say, I mean, for me and for a lot of people, you know, finding ways to channel your sense of injustice for your patients and your sense of outrage is really important.
What about grief? What about grief?
And grief and sadness, you know, all the natural things that you will experience in the face of human suffering. It's important to give yourself room for that.
Okay. Dr. Poorman, I think we're just about finished. I want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your insight and your thoughts, being so generous with your time. Where can listeners find you online to learn more about you or read your articles?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Poorman, Dr. Poorman. And then my website is drpoorman.org, drpoorman.org, where I put my writings. And if you want to receive them regularly and other things that I think are important to read about healthcare in America, then you can sign up for my mailing list there.
Okay. We're going to link to Dr. Poorman's site as well as other resources related to this podcast from exhibit.com/282. Listener, thank you too for joining Dr. Elizabeth Poorman and me for Admission Straight Talk's 282nd episode. I have a final reminder and a favor to ask. First, a reminder from our sponsor, Don't Miss the Ultimate Guide to Medical School Interview Success. We'll also link to the download page from the show notes at exhibit.com/282. Again, it's a free download. Just grab your copy. And the favor, if you find the show worthwhile, please leave a review on iTunes for Admission Straight Talk. We have links to iTunes in the show notes at exhibit.com/282. That's 282. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.